These are the words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. Nehemiah was in the capital city of Susa. It was the month of Kislev. This was the 20th year. One of my brothers, named Hananiah, came from Judah. Some other men were with him. I asked them about the Jews who lived through captivity. I also asked them about Jerusalem. They answered, "Nehemiah, those who are left from the captivity are back in the area of Judah, but they're in much trouble and full of much shame. The wall around Jerusalem has broken down and its gates have been burned." When I heard these things, I sat down and cried for several days. I was sad and I did not eat food. I prayed to the God of heaven.
Thank you for bringing God's word to us this morning. Now, apologies if you think you've walked into a cardboard recycling kind of place this morning. It's not. Obviously, we're doing Nehemiah and we're going to be doing an activity later with that. But building on what Hepzibah's just said, I'd like to tell the story of Nehemiah, really, and we'll unpack that as the service goes on, how that might be relevant to us today. So the walls of Jerusalem had been smashed down by Nebuchadnezzar and his army probably 100, maybe a bit more than 100 years ago, and they were in complete ruins for the whole of that time. And the first century, well, this isn't the first century, this was 5 centuries earlier, but the ancient Near East culture was overridingly one of shame. And it was a massive shame to the people of Jerusalem that their wall was in ruins. They'd rebuilt the temple slightly earlier under Ezra, but the wall remained shattered. So one of Nehemiah's brothers, who was from Jerusalem, had come up and he'd spoken to Nehemiah and he'd said that the wall was shattered and it was broken down and that the people were vulnerable and that there was great shame there. And Nehemiah's heart was cut to the quick. And so he went away and he prayed and he fasted. And he didn't really capture it in the Bible reading, but he actually prayed and fasted for about 4 months before he was going to approach his king, Artaxerxes. Now, Artaxerxes was a Persian king, very powerful. And if you displeased him, he could take your life away with a snap of his fingers. And Nehemiah was his cupbearer. And that didn't just mean he was the guy that handed drinks to Artaxerxes. Nehemiah was responsible for looking after Artaxerxes' life. He tested his food, he tested his wine. I mean, if anything had gone wrong and the king had died, it would have been Nehemiah's life on the line. So he was a very important person who had great trust of the king. And so after this praying and fasting and agonizing about the shame of his people in Jerusalem, he approached Artaxerxes and asked him if he could go back to rebuild the wall. Now, this was by no means certain that he was going to say yes, because previously in the reign of Artaxerxes, quite early on in his reign, the Jews had tried to rebuild the wall around Jerusalem. But Artaxerxes had seen this as an act of rebellion and he sent soldiers and he'd stopped it. So Nehemiah didn't know what the outcome was going to be. It could lead to his death. And he did worry, this could be the day that I'm going to die. But Artaxerxes saw favourably Nehemiah's request and he gave him letters of authority and said that he could go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the wall. He was going to be gone for 12 years. This was going to be a major task and he wasn't just going to rebuild the wall. He was looking to rebuild the people. So Nehemiah went back, but he didn't tell anybody when he got to Jerusalem what he was going to do. And at night, he went out secretly, taking a few trusted men. And we think he took probably an ass or a donkey because they were a bit quieter than horses. And he silently went round the whole of the wall of Jerusalem, which was quite a long way, to see what state it was in and what he needed to do. When he got back the next day, he called the people together and he gave them his letters of authority and he told them that he was coming as governor and he was coming to help them to rebuild the wall. But there were spies in the camp, interestingly, which was why Nehemiah went quietly at night. And these spies informed the enemies of the people of Israel. Now, there were three men. There was Sanballat, who was probably the governor of Samaria, Tobias, who was his sidekick, a high official, and Geshem, who was probably a minor Arab king. And they came when they heard the wall was going to be rebuilt, and they said, "What are you doing? You're going to rebel against the king." And these are the same people who probably got the wall building stopped much earlier on. But Nehemiah knew he had the confidence of the king, and he ignored them, and they started to build the wall. And he was very clever when he did this, because he used the ancient Near East shame culture to his advantage. Each family was responsible for the section of wall near their house. And if that section of wall wasn't properly built, as well as all the other pieces, it would be a shame on them. So it ensured everybody was working really hard and built that wall really well. Now the wall building was going on, and Sanballat and his cronies came back again, and they started to sort of mock the efforts. Tobias said, "Do you know what? That wall's rubbish." He said, "If a fox so much as jumped against that wall, it'd collapse." And Sanballat chipped in and he said, "Are you going to take the stones that have been burnt when the Persians destroyed this wall? Are you going to take the stones that have fallen into the rubbish dump?" And he was very clever because he was trying to play on the whole cleanliness thing. Jews had a lot of cleanliness laws which would have prevented them picking up stones from the rubbish dump and things like that. So he was trying to get the wall stopped. The Jews ignored him and carried on under Nehemiah building the wall. And they built and they built, and things were going quite well. And Sanballat tried again. He came up with another plan. And this is going to be a theme throughout the story. He keeps coming up with ways to try and get the wall stopped. This time he sent people into Jerusalem. They spread rumours that the whole Sumerian army was going to come quick. They were going to come quick, and they were going to come fast, and they were going to come when nobody was expecting them, when they were going to infiltrate Jerusalem, and they were going to kill everybody there to stop the wall building. As soon as Nehemiah heard that, he got all his men, stood them too with swords, spears, shields, bows and arrows in front of the walls to protect it. And there they stood. And when Sanballat and his cronies saw that, the attack never happened. And the wall building went on. And Nehemiah had half his men building and half his men standing there with weapons. And he posted people with trumpets all around different sections of the wall to blow them if anyone came to sort of defend the walls. And it went on and on. And the people were starting to get tired, and they were starting to get hungry. And they complained to Nehemiah, because unknown to Nehemiah, the officials had been giving loans to people and charging exorbitant rates, had been taking land from people so the people couldn't buy food, they couldn't feed themselves, and they were tiring. And this was all against Levitical law. So Nehemiah called all the people, and he called the officials and nobles and rulers, and he shamed them in front of the people and made them forgive all the debts and give back the land so that the people could get on with building the wall. And they carried on. And at night, they slept in their day clothes, ready to go out and fight and defend their wall if anything happened. And the wall was getting higher and higher. Eventually, the wall would reach 16.5 feet high, but it wasn't there yet. And they were building and they were building. And Sanballat decided to intervene again. They knew they couldn't stop the wall being built, but maybe Nehemiah was vulnerable. So they sent letters to Nehemiah saying, "Come on, look, we know we've had our differences, but come and talk to us. You know, we Sumerians aren't all that bad. We'll have a talk and we'll see what the way forward is and things like that." And they invited him to a place called the Ono Valley, which was 27 miles away from Jerusalem. Now, why would they do that? It was quite obvious to Nehemiah. This was a lonely place where he'd be vulnerable even if he took men with him. So he ignored the letters. And they sent another. He ignored that. In the end, they sent four letters inviting him to this peace treaty, this truce, whatever it was. But Nehemiah ignored them all. Eventually, they gave that up, and they sent a letter saying, "If you continue with the wall building, we're going to tell the king that you're actually trying to set yourself up as a king and subvert his laws and you know, take over this part of Jerusalem." Now, this was a real threat, because under the Persians, lots and lots of minor rulers did set themselves up as kings, and what would happen was a Persian army would go out and it would crush them. And so this was a very real threat. But Nehemiah knew he had God on his side, so he ignored that. And Sanballat tried one last time to fool Nehemiah. He hired a prophet. And this prophet came to Nehemiah before the evening and said, "I've had a vision, I've had a dream, something terrible's going to happen to you. The men from Samaria are coming at night, you won't know who they are. They'll be coming so fast, you won't be able to stop them. Your life will be forfeit. They're going to kill you, Nehemiah. The only place I've seen in my vision for you to be safe is in the inner courts of the temple." Now, Nehemiah was probably a eunuch. He was certainly a layperson. And that would have disqualified him from going to the inner courts of the temple. If he'd have done that, he would be liable to be stoned to death, or at the very least, discredited. Nehemiah prayed to God. He took his courage in his hands, and he didn't budge. And nothing happened. And they built the wall, and they built the wall. And eventually, after 52 days, the 16.5-foot wall was built around the city of Jerusalem, and the gates were hung. And this was the first part of Nehemiah's plan, because he hadn't come to just rebuild a wall. He'd come to rebuild the faith of the Jewish people, which had fallen away all those years ago when the Persians had invaded. And this rebuilding, this refurbishment of the wall, showed the Jewish people that with God on their side, they could do anything.
Okay, we have another song. There you go. Take one and go back to Mummy, yeah? Just that one. Oh, not that one then. Which colour are you having? Red. Yes, it. Off you go then. Oh, do you want to look after him for a minute?
No.
Okay. I know, he doesn't look much like a desert fox, does he? Right. Okay. So that was great. Thank you very much for everybody's participation in our wall. John's going to come and talk to us now.
By the way, if anybody wants any building done or walls building, just... I've got my gaffer tape. So... What I wanted to do first was, I'm not talking anything about walls, I want to read you a fantastic poem. It's Shakespeare Sunday, I think, and this is a sonnet, but it was written by Shelley, not Shakespeare, because I couldn't find a Shakespeare one that fitted. It's a really famous poem, it's beautiful, and it's called Ozymandias, and it will become clear later on. I met a traveller from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear, 'My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck. Boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.'" And this beautiful poem was written by Percy Bysshe Shelley, and it was inspired by a fragment from the statue of Pharaoh Ramesses II. And what that poem's all about, if you kind of boil it down in essence, is that men build fantastic works, they found empires, they build cities, they build statues of themselves, and nothing lasts. The winds of time and the sands of the desert sweep it all away, and in the end it's irrelevant. At the time people might think these are mighty works, they're fantastic, but they're nothing, because mostly they're not built on God. They're built on man's efforts and man's achievements, and none of that lasts. Now, Nehemiah built the wall, and the wall did last for a while, but the wall was swept away in AD 70. It was dismantled by the Romans after the Jewish rebellion. But what did remain was the building of faith of his people, and what did remain was the story, because Nehemiah's story became part of God's story, and that is the thing that endures. And the works of man don't endure. The works of man are swept away, but God's works stay. Now, Nehemiah, in the story, he followed God. And Nehemiah took risks, even risks up to and including risking his own life for what he thought God was telling him to do. And this poses questions to us. Who or what do we follow? Now, in this society, there were two great, well, they call them meta-narratives, but the two great stories, really, in Western society. And these stories shape the way we live, They shape the way we see the world, the way we interact with the world. And I don't believe we can follow both of these stories, both of these narratives about the way the world is. And I think we have to make a choice. And whether or not we know it, we've unconsciously kind of already picked which story we're following. And I just want to give people a chance to kind of look at these stories again. What I've done is I've picked snippets from both of these great narratives. And these snippets includes things that people say and things that people do. And you'll recognise them, and you recognise bits of yourself in these snippets of stories, because I recognise myself in some of them. And I think that is the great challenge. We've two great stories that rule our lives, certainly in the West. Which do we follow? And what I wanted to do was just read out the snippets of these stories and then leave it up to you. I'm not here to tell anybody what to think or how to live. I've got no right to do that. Why should you listen to me? But what I will do is read out the snippets from these narratives and leave it to you to think where you lie within that, what you want to base your life on, and reimagining the world, how it would be if one narrative was completely dominant or the other, and what that would look like, and what that would look like in your lives. So here they are. This is the first narrative. This narrative probably grew out of the Enlightenment, maybe pre-Enlightenment, has come right through to us today via the system we've got now, capitalism and whatever. And this is the story. More is better. Buying things will make me happy. I must climb the career ladder, put in the hours, and achieve success. More money gives me more choices. Being busy shows how important I am. Reason and science will eventually solve everything. Society and mankind are continually progressing. Judge people, rate them, rank them. The fast, the smart, and the well-connected people are the best. I must win, get a great job, get a first in my degree, get 12 A stars in my GCSEs, and I will be happy, and I will live happily ever after. My happiness is the most important thing in the world, because I'm worth it. Win the lottery, and I will live happily ever after. A big house and an expensive car will show people how successful I am. Radio 4 recently said, and I just think it was really interesting, our brightest and best people go into medicine and the law. Now, this narrative nowadays is driven by advertising and the media, and these narratives can drive us. The other narrative, the counter-narrative, the alternative to this. And like I said, I don't believe you can wholeheartedly follow both. This is the other narrative. Love God with all your heart. Love your neighbour as yourself. The meek shall inherit the earth. Paul in Philippians 3:8 said, I once thought these things valuable, but now consider them worthless because of what Christ has done. Being crucified with Christ, putting to death all the selfish I and me things in my life, serving others, simplicity of living, regularly thanking God for everything I have, holding possessions, jobs and achievements lightly. Forgive others. Don't judge people. Don't put yourself first. Be merciful. Hunger and thirst for righteousness. Be a peacemaker. My life and my future are in God's hands, not mine. God is driving this narrative. Can you reimagine what the world would look like if we lived by this narrative?